I'm Jane Hampshire of FireDogLake.com, and welcome to Blogging Head's presentation of our regular Fire Dog Lake Book Salon. I'm here with Kim Phillips Fine, who is an assistant professor teaching American history at NYU's Gallatin School. And she's also written for The Nation and The Baffler. And she's written a book called Invisible Hands, The Making of the Conservative Movement, from the New Deal to Reagan. Let's see if we can get the picture of the book here. It's a wonderful book, and I'm really, really excited to have her here today. Kim, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for doing this, Jane, and to Blogging Heads, too.
Well, tell me a little bit about the book. Why did you decide to write this particular book?
Well, I decided to write it, I guess I started working on it in the early 2000s, and I guess the main reason I wanted to write it is that many treatments of the conservative movement really focus on it, many historical treatments really focus on the conservative movement as kind of growing out of populist rage in the 70s and early 80s, kind of the backlash against the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, anti-war movement, gay and lesbian rights. And we see this kind of treatment in the press all the time today, the focus on white working class conservatives kind of as the main force opposing Obama during the 2008 election. And I was interested, I think this, you know, this is, of course, a very important side of the history of the conservative movement and of its present reality, but I think it misses something critical, which is both the role of economic ideas and the economic agenda of the right, and also the role of business and of business people in helping build, fund, and sustain the conservative movement for many years, going way back in its history to the New Deal itself. And I think that if we leave out, if we don't understand the role played by business, we wind up with this kind of distorted image of what conservatism is all about. And, you know, the ways in which it's not really a populist movement, but is a movement of a very elite group of people who want to protect and defend their power and wealth. And so that was kind of what I was interested in, is understanding what these conservative business people were doing and what, you know, what role they played in building the right. So that's kind of the argument of the book. I started out with a question of wanting to really look at what were business people doing during the post-war period, and what I found is that many were much more active in conservative politics than kind of the body of writing about conservatism would have led us to believe.
Well, I think it's a very timely book, considering what happened this week with the teabag demonstrations, which were sort of ginned up to look like populist rage. Mm-hmm. But in fact, when you started looking at it, it was, you know, Dick Armey's Freedom Works and Newt Gingrich's American Solutions, and I think there was the Sam Adams Alliance, which mm-hmm. was a right-wing think tank, and, you know, there was sort of Koch, Scaife money funding this everywhere you went. So your book, I think, provides a very interesting historical context for that. We had Erica Payne on recently talking about her book, The Practical Progressive, which was about progressive infrastructure that had grown up in response mm-hmm. to Rob Stein's sort of famous PowerPoint that went around on the influential intellectual infrastructure that conservative money had built up. How does your book sort of relate to that?
Well, the book offers, one important theme throughout the book is the role that, is the way that these conservative business men, really they're mostly men, I mean, I kind of call them business people, but in fact, in the period I write about, they're almost all men. These conservative businessmen were very interested from an early point, I mean, really as soon as World War II ends and when it becomes clear that the New Deal is going to be a permanent, the changes that it brought about are not going to go away anytime soon. You're not going to see the shrinkage of the labor movement. You're not going to see the federal government kind of getting out of the economy, that these are going to be important parts of American politics for a long time to come. From a very early point, from that point on, these conservative businessmen were very, very interested in funding ideas. They knew that their old, kind of the old rhetoric of free enterprise had failed during the Depression. It hadn't been able to persuade people. It hadn't been able to offer solutions to the problems the country was facing. And if they were ever going to beat back the New Deal, they needed to invent a new set of ideas and a new kind of rhetoric and a new framework for thinking about the free market. And so they were very interested in funding these, in starting to create a kind of intellectual infrastructure on many different levels. I mean, kind of from the most philosophical and theoretical defenses of the market to practical, programmatic, policy-oriented, you know, debates about the minimum wage or about different kind of specific bits of policy. They were interested in kind of giving money to all these different to organizations producing these ideas and disseminating them at many different levels. So I think that's kind of one long theme in the book, and I can kind of talk more about some of the specifics of those organizations. I think, you know, the way it relates to progressives today is complicated. I mean, I think there is a need for progressive infrastructure that an intellectual infrastructure and also one that is, you know, I think both organized around these specific policy debates, but also kind of really fleshing out what are our politics at a deeper philosophical, moral, you know, almost philosophical level. But I think I also think the relationship to funders and donors is complicated for progressives, which we can also, I can talk about that more now or more later.
That's interesting because essentially when you describe the growth of the movement and organizations such as the Chamber of Commerce or the National Association of Manufacturers, who we see entering the picture again today with the Employee Free Choice Act, they're still around.
Right.
They've sort of decided that they had an objective and they were going to find people of like interest or organizations of like interest that whose participation or they could justify in the objective rather than what you're talking about the other way around, which is you have a group of people who are sitting around trying to decide what, you know, for progressives, you know, you're talking about, you know, what do we believe in? They
didn't really care
about that so much as a means of getting to an end.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think one of the things that it's true, these businessmen were very clear about what they wanted and able to build alliances to achieve their goals. And, in a way, it's true. They did a very clear, simple program in a way that progressives maybe don't or have there's just a bigger question about what the program is or should be and so on and so forth.
Well, there's a couple of points that I found really interesting. One was when you were talking about one of the DuPonts. And even at a time when they were making record-breaking profits, they seemed to have this fundamental, almost religious belief in what they were doing and what they were financing that transcended the need to make more money.
Right. One of the things that was very interesting...
Where do you think that comes from? When you're looking at these people, where do you think these deep-seated feelings come from?
Well, it is one of the really interesting things that I was consistently surprised by while doing the research for this book and kind of looking at these people's archives and manuscripts and letters and memos was how intense their emotions really were. And it is, you know, I mean, yeah, there's something kind of almost out of proportion about it. I mean, even during the New Deal, Roosevelt wasn't going to bring about socialism. There wasn't an imminent revolution in the country, especially. I mean, what were they so afraid of? Roosevelt himself described what he was doing as saving capitalism in one way or another. In a lot of ways, he was surprised by the intense animosity that he faced. So the DuPonts, who were, well, I guess during the 30s, I talk about the DuPonts in the book, being involved with this organization, the American Liberty League, it was one of the first groups to really do this, to purport to be a populist organization. They really explicitly said, we're organizing everybody in the country, people from all walks of life, all of us are joined by our opposition to the New Deal. In fact, it was always pretty tightly controlled and financed by a very small group of executives with the three DuPont brothers at the center all along. And they never relinquished their opposition to the New Deal, not even during World War II, when, as you point out, Jane, they did very well economically. The company recovered from a lot of the problems it had faced during the 30s. So what is this hatred about? And I think it's, you know, I think on one level, they just couldn't stand the idea. I mean, that they were no longer kind of being entrusted to know what was best for American society and for the public as a whole. There's a really deep anti-democratic ethos that a lot of these activists share. They feel that they, by dint of their kind of wealth and power in their companies and the, you know, economic success that they've attained, that they also should be entrusted with broader social and political questions. And the sense that they, you know, that the state or that labor unions ought to be able to weigh in on these kinds of questions as well, they just deeply resent and fear that. And, you know, I think on one level there's a certain irrationality to it, but on another level, they, you know, the what happens after World War II, there is a real shift in economic power in the country. The pattern of economic growth that we see in the post-war period, as Paul Krugman and many other people have argued, is one that is more egalitarian. Even though, you know, there's not a massive redistribution of wealth, you see growth without the kind of stunning rises in inequality that we've seen in more recent years. And that's because of organizations like labor unions that help to make sure that growth is distributed more evenly. So there is a real way in which their economic power is challenged. And I think also just having to deal with a union at your company, having to confront, you know, other institutions, countervailing institutions, as John Kenneth Galbraith called them, it does kind of shift the way that people see the power of business and the role of business people. So I think that's sort of one, you know, there is a way in which these businessmen have a sense that they should really be able to call the shots and that their ability to do so is challenged, and they're not crazy to think so. And I guess on the second, on another kind of more personal level, you know, they start to face certain inconveniences in their own lives. I mean, everything from having to confront strikes at their companies to one letter I talk about in the book is a DuPont, it's a vice president or a kind of lower level executive at DuPont complaining about how he can't attract good domestic workers any longer because they're going to go work on New Deal, you know, public works projects.
And $1 a day, yeah.
Right. And so these kind of big questions do play out in their own lives and make things just more, you know, it just more difficult for them. So I think there is, you know, there's a kind of, it gets very personal for, you know, it's not just, it goes, the two things really work with each other, both their kind of major, you know, their large questions about their role in the country and then what they actually have to confront in a day-to-day way.
I thought it was very interesting because when you started describing the post-New Deal era, you were describing businessmen who felt like there was no intellectual justification for the way that they felt, that they mm-hmm. felt very betrayed by academia. Mm-hmm. So their creation of these think tanks like American Enterprise or their promotion of economists like Hayek were very much done or financed with the idea of providing an intellectual framework, mm-hmm. a justification for what they were doing, a rationale that they felt academia had on a level where they felt academia had sort of abandoned them.
Right. They felt like economics departments were dominated by Keynesians at the time who, in one way or another, you know, argued for government intervention, or in some ways, actually, the basic sort of insight of Keynes that consumption drives investment to a certain extent, that you have to kind of, the government needs to play a role in the economy in order to help boost consumption, and that is what, in turn, will create profitable investment opportunities. Like that, in some ways, even that very insight kind of irked them. Because it's the opposite of sort of a supply side approach where you say the most important thing is what investors, you know, what capitalists do, and that will in turn drive growth. So yeah, they felt like economics departments were no longer reliable. They felt like, you know, that academic institutions weren't adequately putting out defenses of the market and that they needed to find ways to do so. And yeah, as you point out, one of the connections that I talk about in the book is with the economist Friedrich Hayek, who was an Austrian economist who came to the United States. And Hayek's career is kind of extraordinary because he, after the publication of his book, The Road to Serfdom, his most famous book, which is a kind of broad criticism of New Deal-style legislation, it's about Britain as well, and you know, which make and it makes the argument that the real danger that Western democracies face in the post-war period isn't the Soviet Union, it isn't espionage, this isn't straightforward anti-communism. The real danger that they face is that the logic of liberal programs, the logic of kind of government intervention in the economy, will inevitably lead, whether or not people realize it at the time, that it inevitably tends towards some kind of totalitarian state. And so this argument, and that therefore, you know, standing up for the free market is not just about economic efficiency, it's not just about growth, it's really about political freedom in the deepest sense. And this was a kind of shift in how people talked and thought about the free market. And he kind of writes this book, and right away a group of business people recognize its significance and importance for their own ends and agenda. And they start to work with Hayek, both to bring him to the United States. His salary at the University of Chicago, where he wound up going, was actually paid for 10 years with money from a small conservative foundation. And they also work with him to help launch a kind of new intellectual society, the Mont Pelerin Society, devoted to, you know, kind of to developing arguments about why the free market is essential for freedom itself. So it's just these businessmen really recognize the ways in which his ideas could be used to advance their political ends, and they worked with him quite closely to help him launch his career in the United States and offer, you know, ways and places for him to develop his ideas. The relationships weren't always smooth. He kind of got frustrated or irritated by their attempts to intervene, you know, in his conferences and programs, but nonetheless, he was able to work with them because he too, you know, understood that they had a common political goal.
One of the things that you mentioned in the book was that Hayek laid claim to the vision and the language of the left, arguing that the free market, not the welfare state, was the true basis of meaningful opposition to fascism. And I found that very interesting, because you still see that a lot today, that these arguments, which seem very anti-liberal and, you know, very opposed to the goals of liberalism, feel that they, advanced by the conservative movement, feel the need to couch themselves in the goals of liberalism. And why do you think that at this point that this shift I'm, you know, sort of looking in the book and seeing that the shift kind of happens at this point. And was that in response to the New Deal and the basis of the fact that they felt that these values were widely accepted at this time?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's a really, you know, all through this period, there's actually a deep struggle also about the word liberalism itself. Hayek never calls himself a conservative. He actually writes an essay in 1960, I think, called Why I Am Not a Conservative. And there's a, you know, he kind of wants to identify with the classic liberal tradition of the 19th century of John Locke and John Stuart Mill, kind of the limited government tradition of liberalism. And there's a whole kind of lot of resentment over the way that Roosevelt had kind of claimed the word liberalism for his politics. So even in that sense, there's a certain resistance to being portrayed as conservative. And that's partly because it's for the same type of reason. There's a sense that conservatism stands for, and in a lot of ways in the early part of the 20th century, this was the case, the kinds of arguments that were used to buy business and by other forces to resist the creation of unions or establishment of minimum wages or health programs or other kinds of government intervention. People argued against them, saying that you needed to protect tradition, you needed to protect social order, that the unions and kind of radical groups were a threat to kind of the order and organization and stability of society. So it's really a shift after World War II to start talking about freedom in this way. And I think there are a couple of reasons for it. Yeah, I think there was a sense. I mean, I think it has to do largely with the failure of the old rhetoric and the old program of, of fighting in the Depression, that the Depression kind of wipes out the old framework of laissez-faire, and it becomes necessary to think of a new way to advance these ideas. and there is, you know, I don't know if it's exactly on the conscious level of strategy, but they certainly are trying to contest a set of terms that have been successful for the other side and to find ways to win them back. And I think it's also a sense you can't go back, so kind of talking about tradition, order, and stability, the Depression and the crash kind of wiped that out. There's nothing to go back to. You need to find a new, you know, so those kinds of arguments no longer make sense. I also think there's a way in which the it has to do with a new perception of being on the outside, that they previously, or kind of prior to the New Deal, the such business people had felt like they were on the inside, and they were kind of unchallenged in their social leadership, and afterwards they feel on the outside and they start to, you know, so in a, they're kind of, you know, they can no longer just kind of make the case from the position of being the inherited authority figures. They have to start to frame themselves as outsiders and radicals and, you know, opposed to what the existing order of society is, and in doing that, they kind of start to adopt more of the language and framework of the left. But yeah, I think it's very interesting. I mean, and ever since then, I mean, this has always been a tendency within conservatism, kind of going back to the French Revolution and the opposition to the French Revolution, this desire to kind of claim a rhetoric of populism and to, just to be outsiders and to position themselves that way. So we certainly still see it today.
You always find, you know, people like Richard Viguerie and William F. Buckley kind of, you know, expressing that tension that exists within the conservative movement. But moving forward, into sort of the labor era after the Depression, they seem to feel a need to combat labor and the idea of the working class as a distinct class and build a constituency. And can you talk a little bit, because I thought it was very interesting, about the way that Pew and others tried to build that by working through the religious right, who at the time were, you know, there was a battle, as there is now going on, between fundamentalist ministers and who thought that traditional Protestant ministers were an enemy to what they were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk about the religious right at two different points in the book, both kind of in the 50s and then again in the 70s. And in the 50s, I discussed this organization called Spiritual Mobilization, which is kind of a strange group, but J. Howard Pugh, who was associated with Sun Oil Company, was one of the main kind of funders of this organization, which I guess it was a strange group of ministers and businessmen, and business people were quite involved in it, who believed that traditional or kind of mainline Protestantism had been taken over by the social gospel, or by the idea that good Christians had some kind of moral responsibility to help the poor. And this group of people decided to contest that idea and to argue instead that capitalism and Christianity there was no contradiction, no tension between them. That Christ, as one of them put it, was interested in the profit motive and appealed to the profit motive because, after all, what is the promise of heaven but it's sort of an appeal to self-interest. So they had pamphlets, speaker series, kind of retreats where they sought to kind of bring ministers in and help kind of inculcate in them, kind of anti-liberal, anti-New Deal, anti-union views. The organization really fails in the 50s. It doesn't take off, and even though it gets kind of contributions from many prominent companies, prominent industrial companies, it doesn't take off and sort of disappears by the end of the 50s. Its leaders actually retreat into sort of strange psychedelic experiments, including the use of LSD. There's sort of a weird group of people around this organization in the end, and it has trouble, I think, gaining traction because it doesn't come really from a religious impulse. There isn't, because it was just too much of a jerry-rigged organization, too much kind of too led by the business people to take root among churches, despite, you know, having some support among ministers.
But ultimately, Billy Graham got his funding from these interests by promising to be anti-communist, pro-business.
Yeah, it's actually, Pew, you're right, there is a, you know, even though this kind of narrow, this sort of narrower attempt to explain why Christianity and capitalism are symbiotic doesn't exactly take off, Graham, gets his support from some of the same people, including J. Howard Pugh, and that is kind of, you know, he represents a much more authentic religious impulse that sort of joins anti-communism, more than kind of a, you know, defenses of laissez-faire exactly. It doesn't have the same kind of economic focus, but joins Christianity and anti-communism, you know, much more deeply. And in that, go on.
I'm sorry, but if you look to, like, you know, Max Weber and the Protestant ethic and the spirit of capitalism, there always has been sort of this sense in, you know, America, going back to, you know, Ben Franklin, when it sort of twisted out of religion and into a more secular theme, but that you get into heaven by virtue of your good works, and that an attempt to take money away from the rich and give it to the poor is messing with God's work, and that being wealthy is actually a sign of, you know, divine, that you're doing something right. And, you know, so a lot of the opposition to the welfare state was based on that kind of frame of reference, and it seemed like they were trying to seize that impulse.
Yeah, no, they are definitely kind of trying to build off of that impulse and to use, you know, I mean, I think that's true, that there is this, even though kind of the social gospel tradition itself was in some ways kind of new at the end of the 19th century. The kind of spread of ideas that Christianity really demanded that people take social action to address the levels of inequality that came along with the industrial age. And that idea and that impulse and that framework has of course never been the only one within the American church, and even during the, you know, during the 30s, it wasn't the only approach, even though it's what these business people kind of focused on, needing to combat and resist.
So talk about as time went on, you know, we hit the 60s, and you've got Ronald Reagan working for GE, which was sort of an interesting interlude, because he actually went into GE being very much in supportive of the New Deal, wasn't he?
In a lot of ways, I mean, he had come out of kind of anti-communist battles in Hollywood, and had when he was president of the Screen Actors Guild, he had tangled with communists in Hollywood and had a strong anti-communist politics. But he also he was a union guy in a lot of ways, and you know, also, you know, supportive of the New Deal, and kind of, you know, saw himself as a New Deal Democrat. So yeah, when he got to GE. By the time he left GE, his politics had really shifted quite dramatically. And, you know, Reagan at GE was a company spokesman. His job had two components. He both kind of hosted the weekly television drama program that the company had, and the other part of it was to travel around to the company's factories in many different states. GE had over 100 plants at the time, talking to groups of workers, and kind of being a public face for the workers, as, you know, not just to the broader consuming public, but for GE's employees. And he would kind of give speeches at the plants and then go out and meet with local business people at the Chamber of Commerce or the Rotary Club. And this part of Reagan's career is kind of well known. People know about that. But I think what is less well known is that GE, during this time when Reagan was there in the 50s, was one of the companies most committed to advancing a conservative economic agenda in the entire country. It was, following a major strike at the company in 1946, its leadership decided that they needed to do something to combat unions at the company, and they hired a public relations executive by the name of Lemuel Ricketts Bulwer. And Bulwer's job was to both kind of what Bulwer did was both establish a very hardline bargaining strategy in negotiations with the union. Basically, the union was, he wanted to make it seem as though the union never won anything for the employees, that it was always the company kind of making the decisions about what it would give them rather than a real negotiation. That was one part of it. The other part of it was a very broad kind of essentially a propaganda campaign aimed at winning over GE's workers to the cause of the free market and limiting, weakening their loyalties to the labor unions that represented them. And he did a whole range of different things. He used the company newspapers as sort of political tools, printing different, I mean, just even the smallest things. People would write in and ask, you know, why is there no bonus this year? And the answer that they would get would be this long philosophical answer about how, you know, people had to do things for themselves, not wait for, you know, not wait for people to do things for them. So there's kind of one, you know, he used the company newspapers as propaganda tools. He also encouraged the entire management structure and all the supervisors to subscribe to conservative magazines, the National Review when it began. He encouraged people to read the Wall Street Journal editorial page. He kind of purchased and disseminated books by conservative authors. He encouraged supervisors to set up kind of discussion groups on their own time in their homes to talk about the materials that he was putting out there. He even organized a class on free market economics on company time, which all of GE's, you know, a little bit roughly 200,000 workers were expected to attend. So it was this very broad kind of effort to inculcate conservative economic ideas in the entire GE workforce. And Bulwer kind of talked about how the company was just one front in a broader war against the forces of labor and the welfare state, and which he kind of saw as inevitably leading to socialism in this sort of very Hayek-style framework. So this was the, it was a really politically charged atmosphere when Reagan got to the company. And Reagan, you know, did not like to fly, and so would take the train around the country going to these different plants and talking to other executives about these economic ideas. And it's hard to say kind of exactly, you know, there isn't a, he didn't leave papers kind of indicating what impact this had on him, but over the time he was at GE, his politics really shifted very far to the right on these economic questions, until by the end of the time there, he's talking about how the progressive tax is an idea that came straight from Karl Marx, and so on and so forth. So I think, you know, it's not saying that Reagan had no ideas of his own, or that this is, I think it's just understanding that Reagan's ideas come out of this world of people where people are thinking and talking this way. And they're influenced by this kind of larger, you know, community of conservative business people, both within GE and also, I think, probably at the chambers of commerce and Rotary clubs, and as he went around the country, kind of meeting people who were part of this developing network.
Well, talk a little bit about the Powell memo, because I think that right. That's one of the most interesting and little known about it, at least in popular circles. Political people tend to know about it very well, mm-hmm. But you know, I think that your book really gets into it on a level that a lot of people can find very accessible.
Well, the Powell memorandum was a memo that was written by Lewis Powell, who was a prominent Richmond, Virginia lawyer at the time when he wrote it, and who shortly afterwards was nominated for the Supreme Court. And the Powell Memorandum, written in 71, kind of grow. Well, just to back up for a minute, I mean, there's a kind of the social crisis of the 60s is reaching a boiling point in the early 70s. You have both kind of the largest anti-war demonstrations that the protests against the Vietnam War that the country has seen. These come in the early 70s, not in the 60s, as people sometimes think. You have the kind of existence of violent organizations, groups like the Weathermen, which are setting off bombs, which generally, don't actually kill people, but are, at these, at the Capitol building, for example, in 71. They definitely damage a lot of property. There is also a spirit of radicalism and anti-business sentiment. The new left is starting to make connections between the Vietnam War and the kind of corporate leadership of the country.
And also Ralph Nader, I think.
Right, and Nader, of course. Right.
They throw up their hands and say, why are we giving press to Ralph Nader? We own the media outlets. Let's knock this off.
So there's Nader and kind of consumer activism is taking off, and in the early environmental movement, a sense of the negative role played by companies and agribusiness in sort of creating environmental problems, and there is just this whole there's also a strike wave kind of in the early 70s too, and this sort of very broad range of challenges to business. And it's more diffuse than in some ways than during the 30s, or you don't have, the recession is not really it's coming out of this period of economic growth, and a few years later we'll see the recession of the 70s, but you have this kind of broad challenge to business. And so Lewis Powell in Virginia has a set of conversations with his neighbor and friend, this fellow by the name of Eugene Sidnor, who is very involved with the Chamber of Commerce. And Sidnor thinks that, that business is now facing kind of the greatest challenge of its day, the greatest challenge since the 30s. And they have this set of conversations, and at the end of the summer, Powell writes this memorandum called Attack on the Free Enterprise System. And this memo kind of outlines the idea that American business is facing a profound, sustained attack, that the kind of radical organizations, just the fringe, the tip of the iceberg, that there really is this broad critique coming from all different walks from American society. Again, he really says academia is academics are very deeply implicated in this, but also the media. And he says what we need to do is we need to business cannot just afford to sit around and let this happen. We fund these universities, we fund these media stations, we need to find a way to get our point of view out there and to respond to these attacks and to use our power to shut them down and to also fund political candidates and get more active in the political realm. And so he writes this memorandum, and then right afterwards he's nominated for the Supreme Court, and so it was a confidential memo. It never surfaces during his confirmation hearings, but is revealed about a year or so later, and in some ways, actually, its revelation helps it get a lot more publicity, and lots of people outside of the Chamber of Commerce, or business people outside of the Chamber of Commerce circles, kind of get their hands on it as a result. So the Powell Memorandum, really lays out a program for business during the 70s. And while I don't think it's the case that there was like a kind of concerted, it's not exactly that there was just that the memorandum, created this response. It definitely helped articulate a set of feelings that were shared by a much broader group of people, and helped kind of provide the inspiration for a kind of impulse to organize anew during the 7 days.
But it also provided an architecture for it, uh-huh. Very much so, between a relationship between, this is what needs to be done. We need to be developing new talent. We need to be monitoring the media. We need to have think tanks. These are the relationships that need to exist.
Right.
In order to be able to make sure that the scene is comprehensively being covered, because this is where we're taking a beating.
Yeah. No, I think it is really interesting. It has this very broad, this very comprehensive agenda that it lays out. And again, like, I don't think it's not like it exactly... it's not like it just by itself, gives rise to this, but it just helps kind of formulate and frame an approach that a lot of people were kind of coming to on their own, on their own anyway, I think. Like, if you look at other documents from the early 70s, you can see this sort of new impulse to organize among many different business people, and kind of Powell is part of that, and then in turn kind of helps, you know, inspire new people to become active. You find, you find people saying the Powell Memorandum was really influential for me in deciding to fund, you know, say the Heritage Foundation or the Pacific Legal Foundation. I mean, in the business case, the Business Roundtable, which is an organization, an elite organization of CEOs only that grows up in the early 1970s. They too kind of are, you know, using the Powell Memorandum to think about what they have to do, what they feel they have to do.
Well, and the Heritage Foundation wound up producing, as a result, I believe, or were they already working at the Mandate for Leadership, the sort of 1,000-page document that they handed to Ronald Reagan when he went in the office and later claimed that 60% of it had been achieved when he was in office.
Right. Yeah, no, they help.
I mean, pretty good.
Yeah, the organizations that produce the, you know, they help the organizations that are created during this period, you know, help produce these documents that then offer framework and leadership for the conservative movement in power in the 80s as well.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting was your discussion of Paul Weyrich and how he says that the thing that really did galvanize the Christian right and bring them into the picture in sort of an organized and meaningful way was actually not Roe v. Wade or busing, but the war with the IRS over segregation in schools.
Right. I guess one of the questions that I had going into writing the book was what is the relationship between the cultural religious right and the economic right? Like, how did these two...
Well, first of all, I used the name Paul Weyrich without sort of explaining who he was. So start there.
Weyrich was a conservative activist who himself actually I think was not from, I think he was a Catholic from a Catholic background, but I should check that, but I think he wasn't kind of from the Protestant world that he wound up working with, but he believed, he was one of the people who helped get the Heritage Foundation off the ground, and he believed that one of the important, you know, electorally, one of the important forces for conservatives had to be the churches and appealing to people on kind of moral and religious grounds, that economic arguments alone, while they were a critical part of the agenda of the movement, they weren't going to help it win enough votes to succeed in politics. And so you had to find a way to join that agenda to a set of social concerns. And you have to kind of find a way to bring the two together. And this was, you know, I think this question of how do you bring these things together? How do you get this economic agenda that really speaks to a very elite set of interests and concerns? How do you kind of, you can put all the money you want to into funding think tanks and into fighting labor unions, but how do you kind of translate that into votes and electoral support? And one of the solutions that people come up with in the 70s is to find ways to bring it together with this conservative cultural politics, which is kind of developing at the same time. And so Weyrich is very deeply involved in that. So the IRS and the schools, well, I guess one of the questions I came in also was this question of how do you bring these two forces together? And in the 70s, it's very interesting. I think one of the things that we kind of forget when we look back on the period is how the religious right in its early years, when it's getting off the ground in the 70s and in a kind of broader way than it was ever able to before with the leadership of people like Jerry Falwell, they really framed what they were doing in defensive terms rather than just saying we need to control the state because we want to kind of legislate morality, because we want to, you know, make a more moral society, because we want to end abortion and we want to stamp out homosexuality. I mean, those are parts of its agenda, but it also very much kind of frames itself by saying we need to resist oppressive state power. The state is actually interfering with our institutions, and we need to fight that. So it has a kind of anti-government slant to it, which is one of the things that enables these activists, I think, to work with the business activists in the end, to kind of form a common bond, a common alliance with them. And they, the IRS and the schools, one of the kind of crucial moments is when the IRS in the late 70s says that it wants to stop, it won't give tax exemptions to religious schools, Christian schools, that are thought to be, that don't have a large enough proportion of non-white students if they're located in non-white areas. And it's responding here to the private school movement in the South after Brown versus Board of Education, when many Southern whites effectively seceded from public school districts following integration to set up their own separate white private schools. And they often did so kind of framing them as Christian schools, or saying that they were just Christian religious schools. And but in fact, what they really were these segregation academies, is what the term was. So the IRS, kind of, you know, pushed by the civil rights movement, is seeking to prevent this practice in the late 70s. And, you know, tries to remove this tax exemption from schools that are thought to be actively engaged in segregation politics. And it's met with a huge response, from Christian conservatives who, you know, say that they're being unfairly lumped in with segregation academies, or also just say it's not appropriate for the federal government to kind of intervene in school policy in this way. And they're really just trying to take away tax exemption for religious schools in general. And this is part of the anti-Christian, you know, bureaucratic state and liberal government more generally. So we need to resist this. So that's kind of what that battle is about. And I think it's important because it does. It's this early moment of the moral majority and the Christian right. People are really. They put their program out there in ways that make it possible for them to create an alliance with the business right that they find ways to, you know, present themselves as anti-government as much as anything else. So it's not, even then, well, it's that, not just about abortion politics and sexual politics, but also about state power.
Well, it's interesting because you talk about sort of the compromises that get mm-hmm. made in order to keep this alliance together, and yet there's always something that's sort of there's always sort of an intellectual tension between the religious right and the business community. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting that when you were initially talking about the DuPonts, that they were very much opposed to prohibition, not because they cared about alcohol, but because they feared increased income taxes mm-hmm. if that there wasn't a tax on alcohol. Mm-hmm. But that isn't something that you could do today. You couldn't say to the business community, wow, well, if we legalize marijuana, then there could be, you know, all this increased taxation of marijuana would leave you free from paying taxes because of the alliance they've built with the Christian right, and that would be complete anathema. So, you know, there's it has mm-hmm. implications.
Yeah. No, I think that's true.
When you talk about, you know, lessons learned from the book, what would you say that you learned from reading this book? I mean, I learned a lot, but you know, about how this organization is put together and how progressives mm-hmm. should kind of look at this.
Well, I guess one thing is, I think that progressives need to not, shouldn't underestimate the depth of resistance to even what may seem kind of relatively minor reforms. And I think one thing that the book really, or doing this work, made me feel is that there is in the United States a very, you know, this kind of mobilized, powerful business community, which has this kind of whole infrastructure now in Washington in a way that it didn't at the beginning of the period that I write about, and that these people are just very powerfully opposed to even really relatively minor seeming reforms, let alone larger types of changes. And just to not underestimate that, that there is that any kind of progressive change, any kind of move to the left is likely to be met with a strong reaction, and to be prepared for that. And I think also, you know, one could say that this book kind of offers a reverse roadmap for the left. I mean, there, it suggests that the left needs to find, or the progressives need to find, an alternative set of, you know, funders and donors and backers who can help create a kind of parallel set of intellectual and political organizations. And I think, you know, in some ways there's definitely some truth to that. But I think the other side to it is that really progressive change in this country has come about through mobilizations, through kind of mass mobilizations, and through a genuine populism that is much more difficult, I think, for conservatives to attain. And that there needs to be a kind of consistent emphasis on how to kind of build the mass organizations and how to really engage people in politics and in the struggle to create a more just society. And I think that is kind of that ability to kind of engage people across, to engage large numbers of people in this kind of democratic project, is the true strength of progressive politics. And and that's what conservatives have difficulty attaining. And so I think the other, you know, I feel like that's another kind of lesson from the book. It's just you know, to kind of to cut taxes and to deregulate industries and to fight unions. You don't actually need mass support to do those things, but to create, you know, a more to build unions, to create national health care, to provide a more democratic structure for the economy, you do need to have, you know, deep levels of support and, you know, mass popular political activity to accomplish those things. So I guess that's another kind of thing I would take from the book.
Well, I hope people take from the book. The teabagger demonstrations were interesting because you sort of see that, you know, their message at this point is pretty incoherent. They're out there mm-hmm. protesting because, you know, government spending, but they never cared about it when George Bush was out in office driving up record deficits. And they take their original inspiration from Ron Paul and the libertarians, who were very much against lobbyist influence mm-hmm. being able to buy legislation in Washington, D.C. But that is very much what the funders of these organizations, who, you know, without whom these demonstrations could not have taken place, mm-hmm. are interested in. Every time we're passing legislation on anything, if you look at the committee hearings, the people that are testifying are mm-hmm. the Mortgage Bankers Association, the American right. Bankers Association, the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. and the Rogues Gallery that still exists from the time that this book starts historically. I mean, they have tremendous influence over how legislation is getting written.
Yeah.
And the only way that they can make that, they can, you know, keep a popular base for what they're doing is to deny that mm-hmm. that's exactly what they're doing. And or to join forces over something else.
Yeah.
And lower taxes, it seems to have been the default message, but mm-hmm. Those demonstrations were not about lower taxes. They were about hating Barack Obama.
Right.
It was pretty
right.
clear to anybody to see. So it seems like they're a bit lost for even though they are still have tremendous amounts of political control, they're a bit, you know, floundering for message these days.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting moment. It's a little bit like there's a lot of parallels between, you know, our present crisis and the Depression, and without getting into those two, you know, you can make cases on either side for the similarity or difference, but there is a deep similarity in that it is an ideological crisis for the conservative movement. There's no question, and there's you know, I think even the ways in which you know, the Obama administration has you know, maybe adopted certain parts of the free market program in a lot of ways. It's still, there's just a sense, you know, I don't know. I think that this is a moment of crisis, and out of crisis can come change, too. So, just as in the...
One of the things that I thought would...
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it just as in the Depression, we saw this kind of total fracture of the laissez-faire intellectual agenda of the 20s. So, too, today, I think we are, you know, just seeing the bankruptcy of these ideas, and more people, you know, are aware of that. And the question is, what will replace them? What exists? You know, is the Obama administration really offering an alternative? What is going to replace them? What will, you know, what will come up instead? But I think there is definitely a kind of, you know, the ideas themselves are breaking down.
Well, I thought it was interesting that when you were talking about the American, the National Association of Manufacturers, that in post-Depression, their numbers, the number of members slipped because mm-hmm. small businesses couldn't afford to be members anymore.
Right.
And so big corporations stepped in and sort of took it over. And it, at this point, we're sort of at a place where, you know, large corporations exist at the expense of small business, even though most Americans believe, and both candidates were touting it last time, that the future of the American economy very much depends on small business.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that Obama did when he first got into office was make sure that that the small businesses could compete for Department of Defense contracts, for, you know, for government contracts, and sort of take away the no-bid status that, you know, corporations had, you know, large corporations like Halliburton had enjoyed under the Bush administration. So there seems to be a breakdown of interest as the National Organization of Manufacturers and the Chamber of Commerce are looking at keeping unions down as their primary interest, kind of aligning with social conservatives on that front and saying it's bad for the economy. But actually, small businesses are exempt from the union organizing laws of the Employee Free Choice Act. So are we kind of seeing a breakdown between the interests of big business and small business? And is it starting to be in the interest of small business to stand up and shake off support for these behemoths that are pushing for legislation in a way that doesn't benefit them?
Well, I think it's... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think there have always been a lot of tensions. I mean, this is, you know, another side to this history is that there have always been a lot of tensions between small and big business. You know, kind of, and the big business organizations often want to use small business sort of as a cover for, you know, to give themselves a more democratic and populist appearance. But there have always been a lot of tensions. And yeah, I mean, I think we may be seeing some of those emerging today in new ways as well.
Well, I can tell you one place that absolutely is emerging is between the regional banks and the Wall Street banks.
Right,
Because the Wall Street banks are getting all this money from TARP, and the regional banks are saying, wait a minute, we're paying into the FDIC, we're paying for these things. They're actually going to be, I believe, increasing FDI insurance payments soon. Mm-hmm. And these banks are saying, we didn't do this, and we're also suffering at a competitive disadvantage because we managed our businesses better, and you guys are suddenly flush with cash, and we have to compete with that because you can practice both consumer and investment banking at the same time. So are we looking at a non-level playing field that heavily benefits just a very few companies?
Right. I mean, I think there are kind of, I think small business is...
Small business may not be the right term to, you know, describe SunTrust and others, but you know, there is like a there's a fracture.
There are fractures, and I think, you know, I mean, in some ways it's as the economy has worsened, and as that there's that helps, I think, create a situation in which you'll see more of these fractures coming out.
Usually what happens in these situations is, like, SunTrust and these other banks will say, oh, I want something too. And then the government will go, okay, well, fine, we'll give you something too. And so you can sort of look in the headlines and be ready for something to go to the regional banks. But, you know, progressives make the mistake of not taking the opportunity to jump into that potential wedge and be able to say, look, this is very much, just, you know, this is what we're talking about. This is what happens. And using this as an opportunity. And that was something that I very much sort of got from reading your book,
right.
is that the conservatives have always been very good at looking at taking a sort of broad view of the various players in, you know, in terms of political power,
mm-hmm.
and saying, you know, how do we drive this wedge? How do we, you know, how do we cut them off from key support they need in order to achieve this? Because the people that they're signing up actually are more our natural constituents.
Right.
And I think that there's a real need to do that.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think, I guess I feel a little wary about, I mean, small business or kind of mid-sized companies have so often been, you know, really just intensely anti-union and intensely conservative in a lot of ways. So I don't know how, you know, fertile or productive a alliance with them would be. But, you know, I mean, I think also what you're saying about finding and ferreting out fractures and tensions and sort of, you know, working them, I mean, that definitely is one of the things that conservatives have done really, really well. So, yeah.
Well, take another example, healthcare. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that you've got to find, I personally think that you have to look at an economic vision of where we think we should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got to see who will be participating in that system in a way that, you know, benefits from it, that doesn't benefit now, that have an interest in, you know, working financially, intellectually toward that.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're cut off from everybody who has the potential to lobby for that,
mm-hmm.
then I don't know where you get your economic support, except when George Soros and Peter Lewis decide to open up their checkbook, unless you can develop the Move On model into a lot more sophistication than it already has.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and no, I think or the question of how to, I guess, this has been a great conversation. I actually have to go in a couple of minutes because my mother is at home with my infant daughter. I sort of said this at the beginning that I had to leave kind of right around noon. So I do have to go in just a couple minutes. But I think, yeah, the question of how do you win something like healthcare reform, and there have been, people have kind of pointed out that, and I think this is quite right, that it's a, you know, it's a huge economic burden for companies to bear the cost of health insurance. So there might be a way in which many companies and many business people would have an interest in some kind of state-supported program. And, you know, I think this makes a lot of sense and is true, but I think it also, I don't know, I guess I would say that the way you kind of go about winning something like healthcare reform, that has to come more from just, you know, from mobilizing people and mobilizing citizens instead of primarily focusing on, you know, lobbying groups and business organizations, and that the level of support that those groups will give will just be kind of qualified in many different ways. And, you know, what you need is a broad program of political education and organizing, and that's where that kind of change will come from.
I agree, but
yeah.
As someone who organizes,
right.
There's, you know, finding financing, that depends on fundraising.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to do that unless
mm-hmm.
you have got a way to fund it.
Right.
So I think that, you know, as progressives, we're going to have to look at alternative ways to be able to fund these things that we haven't really accepted now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can tell you, as someone who watches Washington, D.C. very closely, there is no political infrastructure that is really having a strong effect on how legislation gets passed.
Right.
The game is so thoroughly dominated by these financial interests, particularly, you know, banks, who have been there working to affect things on a lobbying level, on a sort of revolving door between Congress and lobbyists. This is where people think they're going to go. This is where they get their campaign contributions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very, very difficult to penetrate.
It's true.
And I think that we need to start looking at it like the people after the New Deal started looking at it,
mm-hmm.
you know, who stands to benefit from this? Who can we sew together? So
mm-hmm.
I found the
mm-hmm.
book very inspirational on that front, and
right.
I really enjoyed you being there. And I very much hope you, everybody who listened to us today will also join us this Sunday
mm-hmm.
on the Far Dog Lake Book Salon when we will be back again discussing the book at 5 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah.
Kim, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and thank you for all the great questions.